This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, October 21st, the Norris Group proudly presented its 9th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds from the event benefited Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, and White House Catering. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and tickets.
The economy. So somebody that I pay attention to, Kyle Bass, founder of Heyman Capital Management, warned that U.S. is headed toward stagflation. I wasn't ready for that one. So stagflation, part of it is high inflation.
No growth.
Yeah.
High inflation, no growth.
Right. So that, I didn't see that equation coming out. So what do you think we have in the next couple of years? Do we have a recession that's possible or stagflation? What's the opinion of what's next?
I'll go with stagnation, not stagflation.
Stagnation, okay.
Yeah, you know, if you look at the, you know, since the 1970s, if you look at the growth of GDP, it pretty perfectly tracks the growth of debt, right? We've been financing the growth of our economy through debt, you know, since the 70s, and we hit the zero bound, you know, kind of first we skipped on it in with the tech bubble, and the response to that was lower rates, and that allowed us to kind of jump back on the horse. We had the housing credit bubble, and then the response to that was lower rates. And now we've got a, you know, kind of a all debt bubble. Corporate debt's up, student debt's up, consumer debt's up. I mean, it's all, and it's, you know, trended like this with GDP, and now it's all like this, and GDP's like, you know, still here. It had no impact on GDP. And now with that debt ceiling and that debt burden, I don't know how you have growth with that burden. So, and I don't see how you have higher interest rates with that burden too, because to the degree you allow interest rates in any way, shape, or form to come up, that burden grows as well. So you kind of stuck in the middle, and it's pretty stagnant and pretty ugly.
But you do have a surge of population growth that is coming down the pike in the next couple of years, and that's going to fuel demand. And a lot of these folks are younger, and I think the perception originally was that the millennials weren't as interested in home ownership as their as previous generations. I think we know that that's probably not as true as people once thought. But I do think that demographics kind of dictate a lot, and I think the growth in we have more people kind of moving into what I describe as prime home buying years in the next few years than we've had over the last 10 years, and I think that's going to have a continued impact on demand in the housing industry, for sure.
I couldn't agree with that more. And let's do a conspiracy theory of the slowdown from 08 to 12, if you will. Let's take loans and the finance component out. There were 80 million boomers, there were 40 million Xers, and then there are 80 million millennials or Ys. And if you look at how that home ownership cycle goes through with life events, graduating, college, getting married, children, whatever that is, there were 50% less people after the boomers over the next 10-year period of time that would be in the home buying cycle. So conspiracy theory saying if there were 80 million Xers, would we have had the downturn or the retraction even with subprime lending and the things that we knew happened? maybe it wouldn't have been as big of an impact. But I think that continued demand
and
is going to drive
and
us.
And if I could put my other hat on now, which is my NAREP hat.
All right.
Right? We were just, Nick and I were just chatting during the break on how 20-25% of the boomer, of the millennial population is Hispanic. And they represent a much bigger segment of the home buying population for that particular generation than they have for previous generations. Roughly 10% of the homeowners in this country right now are Hispanics, but 17% of the millennials who purchased homes last year were Hispanic. And that's significant because it is a demographic that is passionate about home ownership. And Fannie Mae does studies every year sort of gauging consumer sentiment. And Hispanics have out-indexed the general population year after year in terms of their enthusiasm for home ownership. They are a substantial percentage of our workforce. We're talking about the diminishment of the workforce population. Well, the Hispanic population has the largest workforce participation number, right around 66%, which is about 5 percentage points higher than the general population as well. So we do have a surge of population, but that population is also made up of people who are very passionate about home ownership, and that's something that I think a lot of researchers are missing.
What percentage of the Hispanic households are now own their own home? So nationally, if it's 63...
Yeah, it's about 44% right now. Is it about 44, 45? But interestingly enough, that's lower than the general population, which is around 63%. A lot of that is due to age. So the Hispanics tend to be much younger than the general population, 10, 15 years younger. So they're, again, just kind of moving into prime home buyer populations. One other interesting factoid is that the Hispanic population was the only racial demographic in 2015 that actually had an increase in their home ownership rate, where the general population and every other racial demographic had another decrease. So, again, kind of breaking from the pack a little bit.
Okay.
Can I just interject? I'll be quick. So this Kyle was a client of mine during the downturn when he was involved in housing, and I would not bet against him. And if you look at the demographics, stagflation, with what I told you about the lack of growth of people age 20 to 64, that means the economy's not going to grow very much because those are the big spenders. So there's your stag. And it also means that there could be some real wage pressure going on, and there's your inflation. So I think he's got it right. And then since you brought up the Hispanic thing, I just want to mention one more thing. The immigration in this country has shifted dramatically in the last 5 years because of the growth in the BRIC countries. You've got all these upper middle class people getting on airplanes here with a huge cultural preference to buy a house. And I'll tell you, the home builders, they've got communities all over the country, 80% foreign-born buyers, whereas the net migration from Mexico has actually turned negative in the last few years, right? So big, big changes.
But we like to have a lot of children, Hispanics, so.
We need a lot more, actually, so keep them coming.
Other groups are trying to get the kids to move out.
Immigration reform, then. That happened to be next. Isn't that slick? So do you think we're going to have immigration reform, and how will that impact this product called real estate?
We had a whole chapter in the book Big Shifts Ahead on this, and I'm not going to predict policy, but I'll give you some facts. So from 1990 to 2010, that 20-year period, we had more people come into the country than the prior 60 years combined. So we had massive immigration. 23% of those people born in the 1970s are foreign-born. If you study history, every time we've had a surge in immigrants, there tends to be an uprise against immigration, and they tend to cut the policy. So that, I think that's where the conversation is coming from. What's actually going to happen, I have no idea.
But I'm talking about people that are here illegally. So when Ronald Reagan became president, so you're not dealing with policy decisions.
No.
Okay.
So those folks aren't going to be deported.
No.
I mean, it's not realistic, it's not economically feasible, and it's not really what's good for this country. Clearly we have to, curb illegal immigration. That's not good. But many of these people have been here for 10, 15, 20 years. They're married to citizens. They have children here. They participate in the workforce. They pay taxes. And so I think once we get past the political sort of noise and get to the point where we can start to make pragmatic decisions, which, I mean, that may sound Pollyannic, but I think that's going to happen because we, to your point, need the labor. We have an aging population. We have more and more people moving into retirement years. Somebody has to support those retirees. Somebody has to participate in our workforce, and we're not going to get there just by new births. We need immigrants to fill those gaps.
And I'll throw one more in there since this is real estate. So there is a massive construction industry shortage of skilled labor. There are 570,000 fewer Mexican-born construction workers in the United States today than in 2007, and my home builder clients can't get them back. They wonder where they went. And if you're in construction right now, you are getting a darn good raise every single month.
They're in the food industry.
Yeah.
Along those lines, our biggest trading partner is actually Mexico.
Right.
They're our number one trading partner. They are now the 11th largest economy in the world. And people have been focused on China as a significant economic threat to us. That's actually, in my view, that's a false concern. They have terrible demographics, very much an aging population, and the one-child policy has generated an imbalance of men versus women. And in order to get away from the investment component of their macroeconomic activity, which they're heavily overweighted in investment and creating significant bubbles, they have to raise consumption. In order to raise consumption, they have to raise wages, but that takes away their competitive advantage. And one of the countries that's benefiting from that is Mexico. So the input supply chains run through Mexico here. So that's an economic subtext that is often lost in Washington.
I'll throw in one piece. Believe it or not, we at Zillow Group have a huge problem with immigration, but ours is digital. What we call digital immigrants and digital natives, which is the average real estate agent is 57 years old. Our revenue comes from real estate professionals. But when you look at, and they're digital immigrants, they didn't grow up with them. And some of you in the room, you have devices, smartphones, you're pretty good at using them and they're part of your life, but it's not how your brain operates daily to think through the digital piece. Now we have people that are buying homes that are digital natives. I have two boys, 11 and 7. They were born with smartphones. I mean, and they know how to use them at 2 years old. We've seen it with kids and grandkids. And so believe it or not, we have discussions internally of how do we make sure that the customers that pay us, we can take care of, but deliver an experience that's coming through the natives that this is their way of life. And it's a balance we have to try to address every day.
Yeah.
Now, as far as the real immigration, I think it's a talking point that stirs up emotion, and I don't think there will be a policy change in my lifetime.
You don't think there will be an immigration policy change in your lifetime?
I don't think there will be a major policy change in immigration in my lifetime.
5 years. There will be a policy change in 5 years.
We got to have some opposing opinions up here. Come on.
Well, you know, one reason why I hope we do is because we have to get along on a lot of things and make tough decisions and kind of reach across the aisle. I mean, that's just my opinion. And the next one is sort of in that line. We have, like, national debt. So fiscal policies. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same thing that you've kind of got. What we currently have is we have a very fortunate interest rate environment. We have, what's our national debt, $20 trillion-ish?
Yeah.
Okay. What would typically be the interest rate on that in past 4%? So let's say if it was 4% of $800 billion just in interest, forgetting, so our national debt has a chance, you know, when if interest rates change, to be ridiculous. So it's one of those things where we better reach across the aisle and say, we've got to change some things or we're going to have a problem. So that was really the next question. Do you feel like there's going to be that attitude in the next few years to fix the fiscal problem?
I personally hope so. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that monetary policy has failed. to get us going again, and it's got to be fiscal policy. I think there's some easy things to do that aren't even maybe a problem across the aisles if they can at least sit in a room together. You know, we've got, I think it's $2 trillion in corporate cash offshore, you know, that they can't bring back because of taxations. We've talked about a holiday bringing that back or whatever. And unfortunately, I can't attribute this. This isn't my idea, but I can't attribute it. But to bring that $2 trillion back, no tax, but require that they invest 15% of it in infrastructure bonds to rebuild infrastructure. $300 billion of infrastructure improvement, you know, would be an example of a fiscal policy that I don't really see being, you know, and bringing all that rest of that cash back to the U.S. and U.S. companies. I mean, I think there's plenty of things we can do, and there's lots of opportunity there, and I think it's really sad that we're not having more conversation about that. You know, in all these debates, we haven't really been talking about the fact that monetary policy's failed and what can be done on the fiscal policy side and what are the ideas there. And I mean, that's the conversation we should have heard in these last three debates, not anything else that we heard.
Yeah, I agree. I personally feel that the current and contingent liabilities that we face are actually the biggest danger to the economic future of the company. It's not an external threat. It's an internal threat, our inability to address the what are essentially unpayable commitments. And to the point about monetary policy not working, it's actually working against that in that it's undermining pension, pension earnings and insurance company earnings and those things. So there needs to be a rebalancing of monetary and fiscal policy, and it would be great to hear some adult discussion.
Now, so, entitlements. Now, that word is aggravating to me, to be honest with you, because I don't like ever a feeling I'm entitled to something. That really aggravates me, you know, because I don't feel like that. When someone has worked all their life and they paid into Social Security, is that entitlement seems like the wrong word. It seems like a freebie. If I have the wrong definition? But the math, how does the math work for Social Security and for Medicare?
Actually, Social Security is the easiest one of the entitlements to fix. All you have to do is adjust the actuarial age at which you can achieve benefits. You can do that over time. And you can make it solvent for 75 or 100 years. That's actually easy. It's just the dogmatic political issues that stand in the way of that. Medicare and Medicaid, those things are much, much different.
And how would they be solved? Even if it's painful, it's always better to do it earlier than later, right?
Yeah. But there's no political upside to doing it earlier versus later.
And well, that's funny. Well, one of the years I said something about people making the last statement. It was on a panel, and I said, and I think I'd say that again this year, I wish for 1 year everyone would not be a Republican or a Democrat. They would be an American.
We had 1 year like that, 2001. It certainly felt that way for a few months after 9/11.
Yeah, oh, it definitely did.
I think that's the thing I'm most excited about this election, though.
You're excited about this?
Yeah, I am. You know, you got to find the good in everything. And, you know, so I sit with my, you know, 14-year-old, and we watch the debates and the rest, and he's, you know, he's like, why are these two people, you know, running for president? And what's this electoral college? Like, it doesn't make any sense to him. And it really doesn't make a lot of sense to me at this point. And looking at it through his eyes, at how just crazy it is, like, I am quite confident by the time he's our age, he won't be stuck in this. Because keep in mind, when we were kids and we watched presidential debates and stuff, right, you thought pretty highly of both parties. And I think because of that, we're stuck in this thing of, like, well, it's our job to pick this one or that one. There can't be a third or a fourth, right? We're still stuck in this mindset of when we were kids. My kid's not going to be stuck in that mindset. He's not going to put up with what we're putting up with.
I think that's true. I think that's true. And I also think that that generation is probably the least prejudiced generation ever. I mean, they don't see color. They don't see sexual orientation. They don't see any of those things that we grew up so obsessed with. And so I absolutely agree that there's hope for the future, yeah, without question.
And I think this is the tipping point.
This is the bottom, I think.
Yeah,
right?
You know, you have to hit it. I mean, that's the thing about change. Nobody wants change, right? In 2008, we saw lots of change. But nobody wants change. You know, if everything's going fine, things don't change. Things have to go bad for things to change, right? So not that you should hope for things to go bad, but when things are going bad, you should be going, yeah, things are going to change.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay. Great point.
So we got this big deficit. We have some way to solve it. We're either going to reduce the deficit or do you feel that real estate is a target for having some of our chips taken away? So interest rate deduction, you have a great chart that basically says that most people don't have any benefit from the interest deduction because the standard deduction is so big.
Standard deduction for a couple now is $12,600, and the typical mortgage is $200,000 a year times 3.5% is $7,000 a year. So you get out of expensive Southern California and you go to Dallas and Phoenix, and there's no kick in the pants every April 15th to become a homeowner. That was an unintended consequence, I think, of low interest rates.
But is that ammunition to say it's not hurting anybody, so we're gonna stop it?
You know, I
know you don't want to say policy.
Well, I don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
They've got no incentive to make tough decisions. I think that's the problem.
Okay. Get them out of there. Yeah. Well, we have another opportunity.
You know, who do we blame? We blame the people that vote them in, which is us.
So us.
So.
That's right. We get the exact candidates we deserve.
Interesting. Do we see any?
On the deductions, you know, thing like the mortgage interest deduction, which I know is near and dear to a lot of folks in the real estate heart, you know, if you think about our, you know, parents and generations before us, right, you got a 30-year mortgage, you stayed in that house, you paid it off. And, you know, two policies, one, the mortgage interest rate or mortgage interest deduction, and also the you know, $250,000-$500,000 pulling it out of your house, right? We turn people into flippers, and we turned it into being good to have a mortgage, right? Your goal should be to get rid of your mortgage so that it's 60. It's going to make it a lot easier to retire. But, you know, I talk to people, I say, okay, if you're 45, you should have a 20-year mortgage. If you're 55, you shouldn't have more than 10 years left. If you're going to move and move up in house, don't move up into the most house you can afford with a 30-year mortgage. If you're 55, move up to the one you can most afford with a 10-year mortgage so you're paid off when you're 55 and can have a decent retirement.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Auction.com, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town and Country, Elite Auctions, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA Green Designs, LA South Rhea, New Western, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club, Orange County Building Industry Association, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Realty Executives Inland Empire, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Sunoco Corporation, South Orange County Real Estate Club, Spinnaker Loans, U Direct IRA Services, Weston South Coast Plaza, Chase Photography, Wholesale Capital Corporation, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.